Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. I'm Jennifer Waits.
Hi, I'm Paul Reismandel.
Hello, everybody. I'm Eric Klein.
On the show today, we're traveling back in time. It's March 1932, and a horrible crime has just occurred. The kidnapping of the 20-month-old son of famed aviator Charles Lindbergh and his wife, Ann Mora Lindbergh. Imagine that you were living in the United States in 1932 and wanted to follow breaking news about this story. If it were 2021, the answer might be Twitter or the internet, but in the early 1930s, it was obviously a very different media landscape, largely consisting of print journalism, newsreels, and radio. Our guest, Thomas Doherty, joins us to provide historical context and shed light on radio's role in the media frenzy surrounding the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby and subsequent trial, and why it was a turning point for how breaking news was covered. Thomas Doherty, professor of American Studies at Brandeis, is the author of Little Lindy is Kidnapped, How the Media Covered the Crime of the Century. Thomas, thanks for joining us today on Radio Survivor.
It's a pleasure, Jennifer.
So the 1932 kidnapping of Lindbergh's baby was a massive story, and your book title describes it as the crime of the century. Can you give us a snapshot of that crime? Because I'm assuming that not everybody in 2021 might know the details the way they did back in the 1930s.
I think the first thing to know about this is who Charles Lindbergh was. And most people probably have a sense of he was the famed aviator who flew solo nonstop from New York to Paris in 1927. And he was kind of a big hero. But one of the things I had to capture in the introductory chapter was to give people a sense of just the sheer scale of Lindbergh's fame and admiration. We live in a world of superlatives and hyperbole where everything's the greatest, the best, the biggest. Somebody spikes a football in an end zone and he's a hero. In 1927, in May, Lindbergh was the most beloved, admired, adored person on the planet. He received a level of adulation that I think is fair to say was unique and certainly unprecedented in the 20th century. And it happened not just because of the heroism and enterprise and audacity of what he did, because everybody really did think he was going to die, that this was an impossible feat. And to have this lone 25-year-old American
come out of nowhere. Did you mention what he did? I don't think you did. I think we're taking it for granted. He flew across the Atlantic in a plane.
Yeah. A solo, nonstop, alone. And everyone knew it.
It would be ridiculous in the 20th century to have to explain to an audience why Lindbergh was a hero.
Yeah, right. At least at the time, I usually have to recreate it for my students. And even if you know who Charles Lindbergh is, what you really need to render to appreciate the sort of the magnitude of the disaster felt by Americans in 1932 when his baby son is kidnapped, is that we all identified with Lindbergh. We knew who he was. And if you think of other crimes in the 20th century, we didn't know the victims. So even if we felt we knew Sharon Tate or the people O.J. Simpson killed, if we imaginatively identify with them after the crime, we hadn't emotionally invested with them before the crime. And that was what was so special about Lindbergh. And of course, it's all related to media. When he flies across the Atlantic in 1927, radio, you know, our topic, hadn't yet become the medium that connected Americans in a kind of hive mind. It was sort of the last great story that the newspapers and the newspaper extras had to themselves. So when Lindbergh takes off from Roosevelt Field on Long Island, for the next 33 and a half hours, Americans are just captured by this magnificent story that they didn't know would capture them that way. In the 20th century, we've all had those moments since of shared, simultaneous, universal experience that the broadcast medium gave to us. So for my father's generation, it was Pearl Harbor. For my generation, it was JFK. For another generation, it was 9/11. But in 1927, people hadn't had that experience of being universally, simultaneously connected to something. So when Lindbergh takes off, there we have shortwave radio on ships that are waiting out off the coast of Newfoundland to see them. So they can wire back the information, which will then mostly be put into newspaper extras. A few people had radio, but it isn't the medium of choice that connects us, yes, in 27. And for the next 18 to 20 hours, as he's flying across the frozen Atlantic, nobody knows what's happening, but everybody is connected to the story. There is no other story in America except Lindbergh. And so there are all kinds of anecdotes of sort of the evocative power of this for that generation, where people are really sitting down to dinner that Friday night and saying, offering up a prayer to Lindbergh. There's a famous story of a fight at Madison Square Garden where 25,000 fight fans stand up and solemnly have a moment of silence for Lindbergh. Nobody cares about the fight. Everybody's just wondering, how is Lindbergh? And then he's spotted by ships off the coast of Ireland. That news comes electronically back to to America. Newspapers print extras, Lindbergh spotted. But is he going to make it to the last leg to La Bourget Field in Paris? And when he lands in Paris, pandemonium erupts, you know, not just by the 100,000 Frenchmen who are there to wait him, waiting for him, but throughout America. Lindbergh behaves perfectly, impeccably. He looks like Gary Cooper. You know, he's slender, handsome. He behaves with becoming modesty and grace. He's everything we in the Jazz Age would want of a traditional American hero. And we think of the Jazz Age as an age of ballyhoo and, you know, false gods and advertising. And Lindbergh's the real thing. So people latch onto him as a hero in a way that is beyond comprehension. When he comes back, he gets the biggest ticker tape parade ever given to anybody, ever, and since. You know, bigger than the soldiers coming back from World War I. And people just go bananas in a way that's... I feel like I'm babbling, but you really need to just appreciate that moment. And even at the time, people knew that it was they were in the grip of something that was historic and kind of almost hysterical. So newspaper commentators and cultural critics self-consciously examine this moment. So in that context, what happens 5 years later? And 2 years later, Lindbergh marries Anne Murrow, rich, lovely, talented, a quiet, literary kind of girl, very intelligent, who becomes his helpmate and a terrific aviator in her own right. We think of Amelia Earhart, but Anne Murrow Lindbergh, who became his helpmate, navigator, radio man, co-pilot, flying some of the most dangerous routes in 1930 and 1931, is the princess for the great Prince Lindbergh. And then, of course, everybody is waiting for the princeling, for the child. And so
so they're sort of the celebrities, you know, the way you're painting it, they're the celebrities of the day who everybody knows about.
Or I always like to use the word fame, because celebrity, like we think of the Kardashians are celebrities, right?
Right.
And the famous definition by Daniel Boorstin, a celebrity is somebody who's famous for being famous. Lindbergh earned his fame, right? He got his fame by doing something extraordinary. So, there are accounts like in the newsreels for the next 4 or 5 years. Every time Lindbergh appeared in the newsreels and got a close-up, the audiences would applaud. Just as a signal, yeah, we love this guy, we remember him. So it's in that context when on the night of March 1st, 1932, the Lindbergh baby is kidnapped from the second floor nursery of his home in Hopewell, New Jersey, in the early evening hours, somewhere between 8 and 10 o'clock at night, from his nursery, taken right out of his crib. Ransom note is left in the bedroom. And the report comes out first. The New Jersey police issue a bulletin. AP picks it up, and this is the radio angle I found so interesting. I believe I could say, and maybe since you're all radio geeks, you can gainsay me if this isn't true. But I believe this is the first time in American history that people did what they will do forever after, And that is, instead of walking down to the corner newsstand to get the newspaper, or to go outside if you live in the city to get the newspaper extra that the boy is hawking on the street, extra, extra, read all about it. This is the first time in American history people reached for the dial and turned on the set. All right. And that's what we will do forever after when there's breaking news we want. We'll go to our electronic broadcasting device. First it was radio, then TV. Now it's probably your Twitter feed or whatever, but you're turning on an electronic device to get the news instantaneously. You don't want to wait even an hour to get the newspaper extra. And that's March of 32. And I believe that's the first time something like that happened. And that's
And you're kind of alluding to this. Maybe talk a bit about the media landscape at the time. So, you know, before this point, you're referencing extra editions of the newspaper. How did people follow breaking news before this?
Well,
story?
In the 20s, typically you'd have a newspaper extra. Of course, the print medium had been around publishing sensational, salacious news that we wanted since the 1840s, when New York newspapers realized that people maybe aren't as interested in being uplifted or reading about the shipping reports coming into the port of New York as they are with the juiciest murders that could happen in the big city. And that's the revolution in, you know, tabloid journalism and print journalism. And throughout the 19th century and early part of the 20th century, newspapers thrive in the big cities. New York has at least 12 daily newspapers, major daily newspapers, at this time. And it doesn't even count the Yiddish language, German language, Italian language newspapers that cater to their ethnic and linguistic groups.
And how many editions were paper? Because this is something I was thinking about recently. When I was younger, I remember a morning and an evening paper.
Yeah.
So how many editions of the newspaper might come out in a given day?
Well, it depends on the news story. Say at least three, as you mentioned, morning, midday, and afternoon. And a lot of papers had what they call the bulldog edition. This is all jargon, by the way, that's almost dead because we no longer occupy that media landscape. But the bulldog edition was the last edition of the newspaper in the late evening. And so typically, if Dad were a news junkie, and he wanted to get out of the house away from mom, he'd take a walk down to the newsstand to get the bulldog. That is the last edition of the newspaper, the way we'd tune into the 11 o'clock news. And so that's how people got like normative news. Now, if there were a big breaking story, they'd publish a special edition called an extra. And, and newsboys would hawk those on the street. So that's how I got my immediate news up until the early 1930s. When radio reaches a level of penetration in the culture where basically now everybody has access to a radio. So in 1932, it's like 50 million people were considered radio listeners, but that's probably underplaced it out of roughly 120 million Americans. And then by 34, surveys say 7 out of 10 families own a radio, right? So it's become the transmission belt for the culture at around this time. And what's so interesting to me is that radio reaches this level of penetration right at the moment we have a news story, the Lindbergh kidnapping, that Americans have ravenous interest in. The equivalent might be the JFK assassination in television. That television has that 9 out of 10 families have TV by 63. And television had just reached the level of technical proficiency where they can do live pickups from Dallas, New York, Washington. And things are still kind of glitchy and they're playing it by the seat of their pants. But television sort of matures as our transmission belt. And in 32, we now have the moment when this incredible story meets media penetration.
So how did radio stations in 1932 report on the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, especially since you're mentioning like remote broadcasts of television? I'm curious about how they were able to utilize the technology of speaking into microphones to cover this breaking news event that there seemed to be an insatiable appetite for in America. I can imagine them talking themselves in circles. Like, how much news was there really to report?
Well, Eric is saying that, you know, just doing research ahead of time, it seemed like this case had so many twists and turns and at least 13 ransom notes, I guess. So, you know, along with Eric, you know, how is radio? It seems like there's a lot of breaking news that kept coming about it that people would be hanging
which
on.
They weren't reporting because Lindbergh wants the behind the scenes negotiations kept secret.
Ah,
so that's something that probably wouldn't happen today. That sense of cooperation and the sense of journalistic deference, not just journalistic, but the law enforcement deference to the heroic figure of Charles Lindbergh. Nobody wants to do anything that could potentially jeopardize the life of the baby. Well, radio in those days basically ripped off their news from the newspapers, and they would, you know, basically read, the announcer would read the headlines in the newspaper and then say, for further details, to soothe the newspaper's ego, be sure to consult your morning newspaper. But what happens, a couple curious things happen. First, the night of the kidnapping, radio goes with the AP bulletin and reads the story. So a lot of people hear it first on radio, and they don't believe it because radio isn't sort of a trusted news disseminating medium yet. Yeah? And so they're not real. Some people aren't going to believe it until they see it read in the newspapers. That night, our interest is so great that you tell students this, they find it hard to believe. But broadcasting actually went off at midnight or 1 o'clock. And if you're of a certain age, you actually might remember those antediluvian pre-cable days in which the major networks would do a sign off at 1 or 2 o'clock, depending on your market. They'd play the national anthem, and then it'd be static electricity on Channel 4 until they started again at 6 or 7 o'clock the next morning. And that's what radio, that's a pattern in radio. But what radio did is they kept the transmitters on all night just in case something broke in the Lindbergh case. Hmm. You know? So you get static, and then maybe the announcer would break in. There was no entertainment programming. But just in case something happened, so they wouldn't have to wait 30 minutes for the transmitters to warm up. This is something also that people don't understand about broadcasting, both radio transmitters and television had to like warm up. So when CBS first announced the Kennedy assassination, you probably know, they just put a placard on the screen until the cameras could warm up so they could actually break in with a live image. I know you tell undergraduates this and they think you're talking about the Peloponnesian War.
Thomas Doherty, it occurs to me though, I would like to talk a little bit about, you mentioned the radio hosts when the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped would rip and read, as they say in radio. They would take what newspapers had reported and read it. The reason why newspapers had the news is because they paid journalists to go get it and to write it down.
Right.
And this is still the case today. Television, cable news, more often than not, has to rely on newspapers to write the stories before they can report them. And I think, you know, as near as I can tell, it's simply just the economics of how many jobs there are, how many reporters are getting paid to go report the news. When did radio start reporting, not just
right around this time? Because this is sort of an unintentional consequence of newspapers and the wire services getting mad at radio for ripping off their stuff. They called an embargo on this, that we're not going to sell you our wire service reporting anymore because you're scooping us. You're reading this stuff before it comes out in the tabloid because nothing can beat the speed of electricity. This has the unintended consequence of the radio stations developing their own journalist. And they will actually send people into the field and they will report live for the first time. And sometimes they will make mistakes and break scoops that are false or just communicate misinformation. But one of the consequences of the Lindbergh case is we are now developing this new species of journalist who's a broadcasting journalist. Getting the news on his own because the newspapers are jealous of radio's speed. because nothing can beat the speed of electricity. And they kind of realize they're being antiquated now, or becoming antiquated. At least they're going to have to fill a different media niche than they have filled historically because of the Lindbergh kidnapping.
I think it's interesting that you have sort of two parts of the story from a media perspective. You have the kidnapping and the search for the baby, and then you have the trial. Yeah. So maybe if you could talk a little bit about how radio was covering the trial, because I understand that they had some constraints compared to, say, print journalists.
Absolutely. We can flash forward right to the trial in 35, but there are a couple of media moments that are very powerful, and I think they're the first time they happen. And the other moment, the baby is kidnapped on March 1st, and then tragically, horribly, on May 12th, the body of the baby is discovered less than 5 miles from the Hopewell home, almost certainly killed the night of the kidnapping. And that news breaks on the AP wires, and radio reports it, but they report it before the newspapers go to press. And I think a lot of us have had these broadcasting moments. For one generation, it would be Kennedy. For another generation, 9/11, where you've got this weird vertiginous sense of unreality as the news is coming in, but you're still watching the Today Show, right? Or you're still watching the afternoon soap opera, and then this news comes in from Dallas, right? And there's kind of this bizarre disconnect between normal entertainment and the bulletin that disrupts your life. And I believe the Lindbergh baby death, the notification that Lindbergh baby death, is the first time people felt that. And they talk about it, that the bulletin breaking into normal, mundane, banal programming, and then going back to the normal, banal programming as we're trying to get new news. And there's a famous line from the cultural historian Frederick Lewis Allen, when he says that there are a lot of Americans whose memories of the 1930s are otherwise dim and vague, who remember exactly where they were when they heard the piece of news about the Lindbergh baby being dead. And after that, the whole case, all the stuff that we couldn't report the previous 10 weeks comes out. And I guess before getting to the trial, the other radio moment is we have to remember everybody in America, when they hear the news, of course, is stricken with grief and heartbreak. But that turns on a dime, like a snap of the fingers. Will Rogers talks about this, the famous syndicated columnist and humorist, says it turns on a dime from anger and just the seething need for revenge against the monster who had killed the baby of Charles Lindbergh. And for the next 2.5 years, we're looking for him. You know, I mean, it's that long before, in September of 1934, he's finally captured. And he's captured by a kind of a radio moment in a way, because there's a very famous commentator named Walter Winchell, who I think if your people are listening to your station, they probably know who Walter Winchell is. He was probably the most famous radio journalist, commentator, gossip monger of his day. And Winchell goes on the air. He's got really good contacts with J. Edgar Hoover, who's head of the FBI at the time, and he and Hoover scratch each other's backs. That is, Hoover gives Winchell scoops, and Winchell tells America just what a wonderful, essential lawman J. Edgar Hoover really is. And Winchell has gotten news that the ransom money is starting to turn up around New York. And he starts criticizing the bankers in New York for not being careful about, finding the numbers of the ransom money when the money comes into their bank. They kind of wait and don't remember the people. And there's a bank manager who hears that and says, by God, I'm going to go in on Monday or Tuesday morning and go through those notes. And he finds one. He gets a hit, which is traced back to a couple of gas station attendants who were passed a a $10 bill, Lindbergh ransom money. And on the back of the bill, the gas station attendant has the presence of mind to write the license number of the car. And that's how they get the kidnap murder of the Lindbergh baby, Bruno Richard Hauptmann, in September of 1934. Then into the trial, if you want to go there, Jennifer.
Let's go to the trial. Because my understanding is that radio, there's certain things that radio wasn't allowed to do. And so they take a very creative approach to how they present the results of the trial, which sort of reminds me of, if I think about it, modern day true crime podcasts.
Or the OJ court TV, I mean, whatever precedent or a successor you want to think about. Absolutely. Of course, radio wants to cover the trial of the century, and they figured they could do it fairly unobtrusively. You just put mics into the courtroom and everybody in America would listen, because now we have nationwide hookups on CBS or NBC, Blue or Red Network, or the Mutual Radio Network. All of would to have just one mic there and come to a pool arrangement. So radio, the radio equipment wouldn't be too obtrusive and disrupt the dignity and the decorum of the American court system. But the governor of New Jersey says immediately, once the Hauptmann is extradited to New Jersey, that there'll be no radio allowed into the courtroom. So there's no live recording on radio of the courtroom proceeding, the trial of Bruno Richard Hauptmann, who is this illegal German immigrant, unemployed carpenter, who's accused of kidnapping the Lindbergh baby. And there's a lot of controversy about whether Hauptmann did it or not. You can go on the web and go down all kinds of rabbit holes.
I'm sure.
The web being the web, right? But I think the consensus opinion, and you can always disagree with the consensus, is that Hauptmann committed the crime. People who believe that concede that he might have had an accomplice, and we've never found out who that person might have been. You know, somebody to hold the ladder, assist in the crime.
So tell us about how radio got around this challenge. They wanted to bring microphones into the courtroom.
Yeah. Well, what radio did is they did what you would expect, which is they have reenactments of the trial testimony. They hire actors and actresses to reenact the transcripts of the trial live on radio. And then they have talking head commentators. And going over the trial and kind of doing the post-game analysis every day. And if you're old enough to remember the OJ case in 94, 95, you know exactly what I'm talking about. That's pretty much the same pattern. Although, of course, we had live coverage of the OJ case. There was no live coverage on radio of the Hauptmann trial.
So they'd reenact it the next day.
Yeah, or that night. Okay. They'd actually get the transcripts that night. And also they'd do live bulletins. So you could have a guy in the courthouse or outside the courthouse giving the live, what just happened. But they weren't allowed into the courtroom. And of course, radio was very mad about that, but they had to make the compromises they did. Oftentimes they would have reporters who were in the courtroom talking on radio live that night. Now, one of the difficult things in doing a project like this, and you guys being radio historians know this, is there's no live transcription disc of this. So with the exception of a few archival finds, I had to rely on newspaper reporting and contemporary trade press reporting about how the case went down and how it was covered on radio. And I would always prefer and basically used the reporting at the time to evoke this, because as you know, people's media memories can be a little fuzzy and sometimes actually inaccurate. The most famous example is some of you might know the author Morris Sendak, the famous children's author, Where the Wild Things Are. He was, as a young boy of 4 or 5, he was haunted by the Lindbergh case, because he figured if the Lindbergh baby could be kidnapped, a a poor child like him could be kidnapped and harmed. And he was really haunted by this. And if you look at the cover of Where the Wild Things Are, that little boy in the gray sleeping suit, that's the Lindbergh baby. Hmm. And he actually has a couple of other cartoon echoes of the Lindbergh baby case. And Sendak swears that he remembers Anne Lindbergh going on radio and reading the baby's diet. You know, she famously released a fairly extensive list of food that the baby ate and medicine that the baby took. And he swears he heard her on the radio. She never went on the radio in 1932. Neither of the Lindberghs made a personal appeal the way I think, you know, parents might today. And so he clearly remembers an actress or is conflating it with a movie or something.
Right.
But
so you can imagine an actress performing the role of the baby Lindbergh's mom on the radio for a child listening to the radio. Why would they make that determination between fiction and reality? I mean, that's.
But it is interesting, isn't it?
That's wonderful. I wonder if a lot of the contemporaneous newspaper reporting that you were able to become informed about how radio was covering the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, I wonder if some of these people were just listening to the radio, typing out the news they learned. Is that, do you know this? Is that what was happening?
Well, they had, the press always had a privilege because they were on the scene and they could write up their stories. And the press, unlike the radio journalists who were just starting at 32, had long-term relations with the cops in New Jersey. So there were a couple of AP guys who scooped everybody because they were just wired to the local police and political class. And in fact, that's how an AP reporter famously got the scoop of the Lindbergh baby's death. That he was talking directly to the governor, who got the word from the chief of the New Jersey police, whose name was Norman Schwarzkopf, who was the father, of course, of the General Norman Schwarzkopf of Desert Storm fame. His son was a lot better general than the father was a police investigator.
There's so many interesting twists and turns and connections that you're bringing to other people and popular culture. Yeah. I want to go back. I'm curious why radio was not allowed in the courtroom in the first place.
Well, you might find this hard to believe given how eager lawyers are today for media publicity. But at the time, the courtroom was considered a dignified temple of justice, and the sensational presence of newspaper photographers and radio would seem to disrupt the course of American justice. Okay, that was the model that people had. I mean, believe it or not, right? Because the most dangerous place to be is between between a television camera and a lawyer these days. But that was the model in the mid 1930s. So the governor, I think, going along with that model. But the interesting twist here is the judge, a guy named Thomas Trenchard, a very dignified, old school kind of judge. He was so old school, he actually had a spittoon near his judicial bench. And so he would spit his tobacco juice out every so often. But he's usually considered, unlike, say, Lance Ito with the OJ trial, considered to have run the case perfectly with decorum, fair to both sides. And he sort of oddly, and maybe this is, I think it might be, and I'm just kind of spitballing here, because I don't know this for a fact, but I think, you know how judges are, that this is my courtroom, damn it, it's not your courtroom. And the governor, when he preempted the judge's decision about radio, the judge decides to allow newsreel cameras into the courtroom, which are far more disruptive than radio would have been. But he does it under the stipulation that the cameras cannot film during actual testimony. So when the judge is on the bench or there's a witness testifying, they cannot film. So there are two handheld sound cameras, one in the ante room, or a camera in the ante room, stationary camera, where witnesses can reread and restate their testimony before the newsreel camera after they give it. Then there's a circulating camera, which is taking crowd scenes and local color scenes in the courtroom when testimony's not going on. And there's a camera in the balcony that's taking footage as well. Now, of course, newsreel guys being newsreel guys, at a certain point, they cannot resist turning the camera on during live testimony, right?
Yeah. And there's,
yeah, of course, right? And it's quiet enough now because they've got it soundproofed and they've used different gears to make the camera very quiet. They attach a microphone very close to the witness chair, right? And so when Anne Murrow comes on the stand, by far the most heartbreaking emotional moment. And here's where radio can really come into its own, because the radio reporter, especially a guy named Bo Carter and Gabriel Heater, two radio names at the time, are in the courtroom and they're watching Anne Murrow. And then they come on radio and report very emotionally what Anne Murrow has testified to. And of course, she's the mother of the child and she has the baby's sleeping suit in her lap that she's asked to identify. And there's not a dry eye in the courtroom, needless to say. Anne is a very stoic, kind of old school female, and she does not shed a tear, but she's the only person in the courtroom who doesn't, right? When she identifies the baby's clothing. So the cameras are turned on there. Lindbergh testifies about his role.
You know, just back to Anne Murrow. So there's audio captured of her by newsreel. And so the newsreel footage that's shown, correct me if I'm wrong, is that footage that's shown in a movie theater between movies? And does any of that audio end up on the radio?
Yes, it does. And radio sort of is feeling, second rate, because the only audio recording of the Lindbergh trial live is from the newsreel audio track, the soundtrack of the newsreels. I don't think I haven't seen footage of Anne's voice, but or Lindbergh's, but who's also photographed. But there's a very colorful witness named James Condon, who played a key role in the ransom negotiation, kind of a colorful, blustery guy from the Bronx who just out of nowhere injects himself into the case. And if you're a Lindbergh conspiracy person, the James Condon story is authentically weird. And there are a lot of crime cases that have little odd twists and turns, and detectives will tell you, of course, that's the way life is. There'll be stuff that just will never fit into the case file to make it 100% perfect. It's not like Law and Order where things wrap up at 10 o'clock and, all the loose ends are put together. But the Lindbergh case has about like 26 of them.
So did this character, does he end up taking up some radio time? Is that why we brought him up?
He'd be interviewed on the steps of the courtroom and radio would broadcast that. But also Condon is also the kind of colorful, fun character in an otherwise grim and horrible case.
The Cato Kaelin, perhaps, of the... I'm wondering, so it's interesting because newsreels are allowed into the courtroom by the judge. Radio is not. Newsreels can't possibly be as old as a... They're not that old of a medium at that time, but they're older than radio, or at least have more gravitas, it would seem. That part's very interesting. I'm wondering if there's any way to know why did the judge judge that newsreels have a prestige that's a dignity that is worthy of his courtroom when a radio microphone is dirty?
Yeah, and I face that same thing, Eric, is how to explain that, because the judge doesn't talk about his decision. The best that I can do is that the decision to disallow radio was made by the governor.
He has a political...
And the judge is also reasserting, this is my courtroom, darn it. And that's why he lets... And the newsreel guys, go to the judge and lie to him. They say, we'll be totally non-obtrusive. We'll abide by our gentleman's agreement that we won't photograph any live testimony. But when Condon comes on the stand, it's just too irresistible because he's this very dramatic person. And they have audio of him pointing to Bruno Richard Hauptmann. Now, very dramatic kind of, that man was Bruno Richard Hauptmann. You know, it's sort of a Perry Mason courtroom moment you couldn't resist. But the moment we all really want is when Bruno Hauptmann gets on the stand and the crusading district attorney, a guy named David Wilentz, still a very well-known name in New Jersey culture and politics, trying his first case, his first criminal case, is cross-examining Bruno Richard Hauptmann. And that's the dramatic moment that we have all been trained from zillions of Hollywood movies that we want him to break down on the stand and confess. He's been a kind of a very stoic, unpleasant, kind of arrogant character. And we all want to see him confess.
It occurs to me, I wonder what the Limbrook case, what impact it had on the cultural product of courtroom dramas. Like, there had to have been some courtroom drama prior to the Limbrook case, but it sounds like it must have had a huge impact on how the fictional ones.
We had loved courtroom drama since at least the turn of the century. And in fact, one of the best reporters on the scene, a woman I really came to love, she was on radio as well, reporting for the New York Evening Journal, a Hearst paper, who gave, to my mind, the absolute best day-to-day coverage of the Limbrook trial. It's a woman named Adela Rogers St. John's. Her father was Earl Rogers, who is kind of the, I don't know, Clarence Darrow of his day, the best courtroom reporter in San Francisco, Jennifer. In fact, that's where they came from. The San Francisco Examiner being the Hearst paper there. And Adela was a hard-boiled reporter. She had watched her father in action since the age of 9. She was a real daddy's girl, and dad used to take her to all his cases. She didn't get along with her mother. And so she had been in court, you know, watching the best guy in the business for 15 years. And then she goes into journalism, and she's a woman. So she can play the female angle the way the boys can't.
Did you say that she appeared on the radio as well as being a print journalist?
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Right. So this is, you've been telling us, Thomas Doherty, a story about the Limbrook baby kidnapping and how it played out on radio, a new medium in the United States at the time, and how newspaper reporters as well as photojournalists were sort of out in front of radio at this moment. But of course, some of these print journalists are going to use radio to for their own reasons. So what can you tell us about Adela Rogers St. John, how she would use radio? Or appear on the radio.
She and of course the other big name there is Walter Winchell. They're all engaged in now this cross media pollination. So Winchell has his syndicated column, which is all over America. He has his national broadcast on Sunday nights, and he's in the courtroom as well. And then he also gets into Hollywood. He writes Hollywood scripts, and he's plays a Hollywood angle himself. And Adela Rogers St. John, same thing. She's a print journalist who that night is on the nightly radio shows that the New York Herald, Evening Journal is broadcasting in tune with the trial. So when the trial ends, they all walk over to a radio transmission booth and have a postmortem, the various reporters. And it's very typical of what TV does today.
Did the Hearst papers get a cut of this, or is this Rogers St. John's industry? Does it benefit?
This is all Hearst, because what Hearst has done too is they've hired the defense attorney Edward Riley, so they have a sort of first crack at Big Ed Riley, who's this blustery defense attorney, and they've bought access to Anna Hauptmann, who is Bruno Hauptmann's wife. So there was a species of female reporter at the time that most of the big newspapers had. And these women went on radio, too. And they were called sob sisters. That was the name for this special genre. And typically it'd be a woman who would get close to the widow of the or the future widow of a gangster who is going to be executed, or the mother of the gangster who is going to be executed. And, you know, she'd walk into the lonely apartment and the picture of the boy, and, you know, and basically she was supposed to draw tears from her female readership. And it's I think a lot of, you know, female journalists at the time, and certainly in literature since, think of the term as a little condescending, more than a little condescending, the Sob Sisters. But Adela Rogers St. John took it as a badge of honor. She said, "Darn right, I'm a Sob Sister. I want my readers to feel the emotion of the moment. I want them to be involved. And if I can make them cry, so much the better." So when she writes about Anne Murrow on the stand, you know, people, I mean, it's really a tour de force of reporting. She did 15 to 2,000 words on Deadline for 6 weeks. You know, and there are stories of male editors not going home after the day is done until Adela's work would come in over the teletype, because they were so eager to read her reporting. And she would also be on radio. Unfortunately, I couldn't find any of those what sound like fascinating accounts of the radio reporting that night from the New York Herald.
You're talking about
the Evening Journal.
I know, that's unfortunate. I mean, it would be amazing to hear that audio. I'm also struck by, you're talking about people staying late into the newsroom, and you've mentioned that transmitters on the radio were kept on all night. People perhaps were listening to static until they heard breaking news about the Lindbergh case.
In 32,
So I'm just curious, like, how, I know a big tenet of this project of yours is that this really began the era of the 24-hour, or began the idea of a 24-hour news cycle. So maybe if you could talk more about that.
Well, what I think is the importance of this case, which, remember, goes from, say, you know, 27 with Lindbergh, 32 with the kidnap murder, and then 35 with the trial, is this extended story that we see the three pillars or tributaries of modern media, which is the print, broadcasting, and newsreels, moving image, and of course, broadcasting then becomes television. Those three pillars established in covering a case, okay? And so each of them realizes they have their own niche. So what print gives us is comprehensiveness of coverage, the trial transcripts, illustrations, maps, the sort of close textual analysis that you need to really understand the case. And of course, people are absorbed in this case the way a latter generation is going to be in the absorbed in the OJ case. And Eric mentioned Cato Kalin, right? So if you're of a certain age, you know exactly who he's talking about, right? But if you're maybe a little younger, you know, who's Cato Kalin? What's his importance? But during the OJ case, you know all the little details of the various personalities, right? If the glove don't fit, you must acquit, right? We even know the catchphrases. Similarly, with the Lindbergh trial, people at the time knew who John Condon was. They knew his nickname. They knew the name of the guy who did the forensic wood analysis. And by all accounts, the guy who did something as, I mean, it sounded as boring as, you know, possible, who did the search to track down where the lumber from the ladder found at the, you know, on the lawn of Lindbergh house, where that lumber came from. And it's like this detective story, this obsessive compulsive wood expert kind of narrows it down to a lumber yard in the Bronx. And by all accounts, this like riveted the courtroom for hours on end, this story. So print gives us that kind of comprehensiveness of coverage. Radio gives us the instantaneous news, right? So nothing can beat radio now for instantaneous coverage. And then the newsreels give us the motion picture, the visceral power of the moving image. And so gradually they all kind of realize we have our own, you know, alleys, and you don't want to get out of your alley too much. The newsreels try to do things like reproduce the handwriting notes and you know, the maps and explain that. But what the newsreels are best at, of course, is the emotional power of the testimony.
And, you know, and speaking of that, it's intriguing. You know, one thing that you're not mentioning as you're outlining these different roles, it's like a whole different category is when radio was doing these reenactments, which sounds so fascinating to me. And they sound like radio dramas where you had actors reenacting the transcript. And is that something that had ever been done before or continued after the trial? It sounds really intriguing to me.
Oh, it is. And you probably know, or your listeners probably know, about the most famous example of this is the March of Time, which was the radio broadcast, which is sort of a 30-minute dramatization of the news of the day, sponsored by Time Magazine. And they go on radio with this show. Now, unfortunately, during the original kidnapping in 32, the March of Time was off the air for a hiatus. Then they go back on the air. The March of Time is actually, I believe, the first time you had sort of an audience campaign to get a broadcasting show back on the air, because it didn't do Time Magazine all that much in terms of advertising revenues, but it was sort of had this elite cultural cachet, and the people who liked the March of Time as being this, you know, educational, newsworthy show, loved it with a passion. So they really campaigned, kind of like, you know, Star Trek people, or you know whatever your example might be, the modern one. But I believe that's the first time that sort of audience protest had a show continue. So the March of Time, when Lindbergh, or when Hauptmann is captured, does dramatizations of his interrogation, and they had a special guy, Don Weist, who did Hauptmann. And so over a period like of 2 years, he sort of identifies with Hauptmann, because he's doing the German accented voice. And he actually goes down to Flemington, New Jersey, which is where the trial was held, to observe Hauptmann's face, because he felt like the muscle structure and the facial physiognomy would give insight into the vocal pattern. And he kind of had this odd identification in the end with Hauptmann that he speaks about. So he played Hauptmann, you know, throughout the course of the trial. And there are a few of those available. You know, the one after Hauptmann's captured in September of 1934 exists, but I wasn't able to find any of the more recent ones about the trial. The New York Public Library has a pretty good collection of those radio March of Times, which your listeners probably know best because of its newsreel version. So after it becomes a success on radio, it becomes a newsreel screen magazine in 1935, which your listeners probably know best through its famous parody in Citizen Kane.
That's what I was going to, yeah.
Yeah, you got to mention that, Eric. Yeah.
Well, that's it's the only thing I know. Backward reels the mind.
Exactly. Apparently,
I got half of that right.
There are stories that if you came into Citizen Kane 10 or 20 minutes late, which people were prone to do back in the day, you might have thought you were actually watching the real March of Time, which they showed before the feature film. And that's, of course, Wells wanted to play with your head the same way he played with your head with War of the Worlds in 1938, right? To make you think it was real. So Orson Welles gives us the first great broadcasting parody with War of the Worlds. And he also gives us the first great, what you might call, documentary in Citizen Kane.
Backward, you know? Ran so sentences until reeled the mind is the writing style just the famous, they were mocking.
The voice, I don't know if you know the voice, who narrated both the radio and the newsreel version, or the screen magazine version of the March of Time, was this fellow called Westbrook Van Voorhees, who is the classic voice of God from any documentary you've ever seen, right? It's that sort of baritone of authority. And he really does sound like he's, you know, live from Mount Olympus, Westbrook Van Voorhees. And Wells got a member of his Mercury Theater to just give this spot-on imitation. So audiences in 41 would have had that radio echo of Westbrook Van Voorhees that they would have appreciated.
Thomas Doherty, you wrote a book. You're the author of the book, Little Lindy is Kidnapped, How the Media Covered the Crime of the Century. We've been talking about how from 1927... through till the mid-30s, you know, the United States media audience was hooked on this crime story, how it was covered both as a breaking crime and then the police investigation, as well as the trial of the century, they called it. I'm wondering if you can tell us at all how this story changed radio. When it was all over, how was radio different?
Well, there are two things. First, radio knows, and we know, that it will now be our source for breaking news. You know, that's where we go. We'll no longer go to the newspaper extra. And radio has developed now a farm team of radio journalists that are now schooled in news. So during the original kidnapping in 1932, radio is doing things that it had never done before. Like they're sending out vans and trucks all around New Jersey, and you're doing through shortwave multiple pickups, right? So I've got like somebody in Princeton, somebody in Trenton, somebody in Philadelphia, and we're all going to be on the same radio show. And so the technicians are developing real expertise and just sort of the network technology of radio, which will serve them in good stead for every story that we're going to be covering throughout the 1930s. And then, of course, the radio journalist is also learning how to deal with inarticulate witnesses, to speak, to ad lib off the top of his head, to both to master the story well enough that I can communicate it to my listeners and then sort of roll with the punches if something else happens, which are skills that we really hadn't had any need for before that. And so all the great stories of the 1930s are going to call upon that expertise of the radio broadcast journalist, which is like a new phrase. Yeah. Like they were just announcers. They read stuff, but now I am communicating this to my audience. And the other thing I think is the creation of this new broadcasting creature, the commentator, because one of the things about the Lindbergh case, and this is going to be true of the New Deal, and of course, you know, the menace of Nazism in Europe, it's not enough for me just to spew the headlines at you. What I want as a radio listener now is I want you to be a guide to lead me through with your critical intelligence what's important. I want you to explain it to me. I want you to tell me why I should pay attention to the Munich Pact and the invasion of the Sudetenland, which I could not locate on a map. But I want you to tell me why that's important and why that might disrupt my life in Iowa City. And the great broadcast journalist could do that. So, you know, also in this tradition is probably the most famous of them all who didn't cover the Lindbergh case, Edward R. Murrow, right? Because that's why we'd listen to Murrow, as he could give us the emotion and the drama of the story, but he could also tell us why it was important. And so the radio broadcasters of this era can explain the forensic evidence, can explain the trail of circumstantial evidence that leads us inevitably to the conclusion, even though there's no kind of smoking gun fingerprint, that of course Bruno Hauptmann is the only person who could have done this.
Thomas Doherty, professor of American Studies at Brandeis, author of Little Lindy is Kidnapped, How the Media Covered the Crime of the Century. If you'd like to hear the continuation of our interview with Thomas Doherty, it's online at radiosurvivor.com. This is episode number 314, but the radio version of today's episode has to conclude now. My name is Eric Klein. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week.